Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. And I, for one, hardly ever check my junk mail folder, writhing pit of digital horrors that it is. But Rebecca Connors does, and we should thank her for it.
Just happened to look in my junk mail and saw this email that supposedly was from Proud Boys. And I thought, all right, just another junk mail. But then I look and it says, you know, if you don't vote for Trump, we're going to come after you. And then I look down and I see my legal Florida address. And I thought, okay, that's freaky, you know.
Rebecca is a Florida voter. Her husband is in the military, so they're stationed in San Antonio, Texas right now. She's voting absentee. And Rebecca had heard the president tell the Proud Boys, a far-right hate group, to stand back and stand by in that first presidential debate. So seeing Proud Boys in the email header set off alarm bells.
You know how you get like a fake email from Netflix, and it'll say it's from Netflix, right? But when you click on it, you see that it's actually not from Netflix, but some weird random email that's obviously not Netflix. So this email showed you that the recipient was Proud Boys. And I expected to click on it and see that it was from some random weird email. But when I saw that it actually said official, you know, Proud Boys, and it appeared to be a legitimate email from Proud Boys, that was a little more concerning.
Rebecca alerted the Brevard County Supervisor of Elections, who notified federal authorities. Then she posted about it on Facebook.
Immediately, my mother responds, "This is terrifying." My mother's also a Florida resident. She calls my dad, and my legal Florida address is my father's home. She calls my dad in a panic. And, you know, I thought, it's people like her. Myself, I realized this wasn't real. No one was going to come after me. My vote was safe. But I was thinking about people like my mother in Florida who are going to believe that this is real and that someone really is going to come after them.
We have already seen Iran sending spoofed emails designed to intimidate voters, incite social unrest, and damage President Trump.
On Wednesday of last week, in a hastily announced evening press conference, the FBI and intelligence community announced that Russia and Iran are behind efforts to interfere with voting. Specifically, the Director of National Intelligence, John Ratcliffe, said that Iran had sent the fake Proud Boys emails. Well, Rebecca Connors is skeptical that the campaign was aimed at damaging the president.
I already associated Trump with the Proud Boys. I mean, I didn't need this email to associate him with the Proud Boys. I already associate them. So I personally don't buy that argument. That just doesn't stand up to logic and reason. And when I saw the fear that this email created in others, I just felt like, okay, this is... something that is designed to make people afraid to go vote.
Well, Nina Jankowicz, let me just ask you first, what were those emails designed to do?
Yeah, I think Rebecca is exactly right, Meghna. These are designed to suppress voters, first of all, and they're also designed to cause chaos and confusion and distrust in the system writ large. Just from my own personal experience, I was phone banking this weekend, and a woman that I talked to didn't want to answer very, you know, routine, mundane questions that phone bankers normally asked because she was afraid I might be a troll. That's what she told me. So I think, you know, these things are really having an effect on American voters during this election season when millions of Americans are going to the polls as we speak.
And did you tell this woman, actually, I'm a disinformation expert, and you are right to worry that there might be trolls using phone banks? I mean, wow.
Well, I mean, I personally hope no trolls are using phone banks. That would be pretty hard to do from Tehran or from Moscow or St. Petersburg. But, you know, I just politely thanked her for her time and got off the phone, because I think that fear has become pretty endemic against a lot of informed people who are worried about, you know, what's going on in our country and the outcome of this election right now.
So when I said you're a disinformation expert, I should give your full CV here, because Nina Jankowicz is a disinformation fellow at the Wilson Center, a nonpartisan think tank, and author of How to Lose the Information War: Russia, Fake News, and the Future of Conflict. We had Nina on the show a little while ago and have invited her back, because as we're getting just ever so close to the end of voting, to November 3rd, we're seeing more sort of public evidence of disinformation campaigns. And Nina, we wanted you back to help us sort through them. And I've been using the phrase dissect them, so we can understand the anatomy of how these campaigns work. So let's talk a little bit more about what DNI Ratcliffe said on Wednesday, that Russia and Iran in particular had targeted American voters, seems to be mostly Democrats, by obtaining voter data. Do we saw shades of this in 2016? Is this the logical next step in terms of how foreign actors want to sow distrust in the election?
Well, first, it's really important to note, just for everyone listening, that all of this voter data is actually public, so anybody can request it. It's not like they obtained this data through hacking or anything else. This is public data that can be requested by anyone, apparently even foreign adversaries, probably under, you know, some sort of guise, right? But it's data that's available to campaigns, it's available to advocacy groups, it's available to folks who are conducting oversight of the election. So just understand that it wasn't hacked. That's okay. Important to underline. But using this data, I think this is a second step, right? Beyond what we saw in 2016, you know, the use of fake accounts online to make things trend, to change the online discourse. What we're seeing now is a trend toward more encrypted, more covert, more personalized disinformation campaigns. And we've seen this in a couple of areas. Earlier in the coronavirus crisis, right at the very beginning, before we went on lockdown, you may recall there were a lot of fake text messages going around that claimed the United States was heading into martial law. It came out later that these were actually from China, again, to provoke that discord, that unrest, that distrust in government. And this is a similar tactic that we're seeing here from Iran. Luckily for, you know, the United States and voters who are casting their ballots right now, it was uncovered fairly quickly, because it was there was a mistake made when they created a fake video that uncovered the IP address that the Iranian hackers were using to kind of create this this fake campaign. But I think, you know, there's a difference in how people trust information that's being communicated to them through social media versus an email that, as Rebecca pointed out in the opening, has your legitimate mm-hmm. voting address at it. There's an air of officiality to it. There's an air of trust. You know, if somebody has your email and this information, that makes it seem a little bit more legit, particularly for folks who might not be as critical consumers of information and be following how these sorts of campaigns are run lately.
So are you satisfied with the evidence that in this specific case regarding these emails sent to voters, these threatening emails, that it was indeed Iran, as Ratcliffe said last week?
So, you know, I'm not a cybersecurity expert, but the folks who I trust who are satisfied that it is Iran, based on that kind of mistake that they made in uncovering their IP address in this fake video that showed how they were targeting voters, that was released along with the emails. But here's what I you know, take objection to in DNI Ratcliffe's announcement. He mentioned Iran and Russia, but he really did not explain anything we were seeing related to Russian influence campaigns. And I think this paints kind of a confusing picture to the non-expert. It makes it look like, okay, here's Iran doing this horrible thing. Russia might have some voter files, but we're not going to tell you about that. Meanwhile, less than 24 hours later, we heard an announcement announcement from the FBI and from the Department of Homeland Security's Cyber and Infrastructure Security Agency, which is endowed with protecting our election infrastructure. They said, actually, Russia has gotten into several state and local networks and in two cases exfiltrated data. So this data, this understanding that Russia was doing something pretty serious was probably, within the intelligence community the day that DNI Ratcliffe made that announcement. And he chose not to emphasize that in that press conference. And to me, that seems like a political ploy. Rebecca touched on this in her commentary, too. It's about making it look like these campaigns are seeking to target President Trump, when in reality, it's about targeting our democracy, mm-hmm. our democratic discourse, and voters, keeping them from making informed decisions, keeping them from trusting in the system that is supposed to count their votes and make their voices heard. This should not be a partisan issue. And this is a pattern of behavior that we've seen from the DNI over the past couple of months in the lead up to the election. And it's really worrisome to me.
So here's an example. Just to rephrase what you're saying, that the point of these campaigns, these disinformation campaigns, is to sow discord and distrust. And it sounds like, in your view, the way it was publicly managed by the Director of National Intelligence further sows mistrust.
Yeah, exactly. And again, this is a pattern of behavior. And, earlier in the summer, when we heard notifications from the intelligence community about the ongoing interference activity, they placed an emphasis on China. Russia and Iran were included in there. But again, the emphasis was on China and that China was trying to detract from President Trump. We also saw just recently at the beginning of the fall, DNI Ratcliffe making a really bizarre decision to declassify some unverified intelligence about the 2016 election that kind of dredged up the whole Hillary Clinton email scandal and the hack and leak operation perpetrated by the Russians. And again, that seemed to be a political decision to help President Trump. All of this should not be a political conversation. This is a nonpartisan issue. It affects Americans' information. It affects their ability to cast their ballots. And it affects trust in our democratic system that will go far, far beyond the outcome of the November 3rd election. We need to be informing Americans to the best of our ability about the wide variety of threats that we see, and we need to inform them in a detailed way, including the fact that, Russia is the most practiced of these three actors that we've talked about today, and we shouldn't detract from that fact just because it's politically inconvenient.
Well, when we come back from a break, we are going to go deep into an example of a Russian disinformation campaign that had an impact on Ukraine but took place in the Netherlands. So, Nina, stand by here for just a second. We are trying to understand the anatomy of a disinformation campaign today, and we'll have more when we come back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Today, we are dissecting the anatomy of a disinformation campaign to understand how they're launched, what impact they have, and how to recognize them. So we're trying to give each other tools here to fight back against disinformation in American democracy. And I'm joined today by Nina Jankowicz. She is the Disinformation Fellow at the Wilson Center, a nonpartisan think tank, and author of How to Lose the Information War, Russia, Fake News, and the Future of conflict. Now, Nina, for the next several minutes, I'm going to use you as my reporter here, okay? Because we talked to someone that you featured in your book. His name is Dmytro Kuleba, and he's Ukraine's Minister of Foreign Affairs. And he walked us through a fascinating story about a disinformation campaign that actually took place in the Netherlands, okay? So this has to do with a 2016 referendum that took place in the Netherlands about a trade agreement between Ukraine and the European Union. And here's how Dmytro Kuleba described it.
The referendum was about Ukraine, was only partially about Ukraine. It was also about the attitude of the Dutch society towards the EU. And the third element, it was this thrilling experiment that the Dutch society was undertaking to hold a referendum of that kind.
So Nina, set the table here. This 2016 referendum, what was it all about?
Well, to understand it, we really need to go back to 2013 and 2014. Your listeners might remember the Euromaidan protests that took place in Ukraine. That basically was Ukrainians protesting then-President Viktor Yanukovych's decision to renege on closer relations with the European Union and, you know, the signing of that original association agreement with the EU in favor of closer ties with Russia. So they came out on the streets by the thousands, hundreds of thousands across the country for many, many months. And essentially, this became like the defining factor of this new era of Ukrainian politics. Eventually, Yanukovych left Ukraine. He fled. New elections were held. President Petro Poroshenko came into power. And they, the Ukrainian government, worked toward the signing of that new association agreement with the EU and closer ties with the West. That's what, you know, Ukraine has been working toward for a long time now. And when this association agreement came up for ratification, Russia saw an opportunity here. The Netherlands was a famously Eurosceptic society, didn't like EU influence over its internal affairs, and had kind of a sore relationship with Ukraine because during the Ukraine conflict that came after those protests on the Maidan in 2013 and 2014, there was the shoot down of Malaysian airliner MH17, yes. Mm-hmm. Which originated in Amsterdam and had a lot of Dutch citizens on it. And there was all of this confusion about who was responsible. Now, make no mistake, Russia and the separatists it sponsored were responsible for the downing of that airliner in eastern Ukraine. But because of the disinformation around it, there was, again, this kind of sore spot. And so, again, Russia sees this opportunity in Ukraine and the Netherlands not only to undermine Euro-Atlantic unity and EU unity, EU cohesion, but also to undermine Ukraine's Western aspirations. And so it launches a disinformation campaign.
Okay, so this is how Kuleba described how that campaign worked to us. Now, at the time, he was Ukraine's ambassador at large for strategic communications, and his job was actually to mount a public relations campaign in support of Ukraine and the EU to convince the Dutch to support this referendum. That was actually his job. And as you mentioned, Nina, at the same time, Russia mounts its own disinformation campaign in the Netherlands.
They simply carefully studied what was dividing the Dutch society, what were the burning issues in domestic politics, and started playing with that. And that was the tactic applied. It's like, you know, you have an open wound, and instead of healing it, someone sticks his finger into the wound and starts digging it. That's what Russia does.
You know, Nina, we actually talked to Kuleba a couple of days ago, and that image of sticking a finger in an open wound has just stuck with me for days. What exactly did the Russians do in the Netherlands?
Yeah, so it's a perfect image for Russian tactics all over the world. It's what they've done here, too. You're seizing on these fissures in society and amplifying them. So in the case of the Netherlands, using things like RT and Sputnik in Dutch, which are these overt propaganda arms of the Russian government, they had a lot of false narratives, including that the Dutch army would have to go to Ukraine and fight in Ukraine's war if the association agreement were signed. They claimed that Ukrainians would be immigrating en masse to the Netherlands if this association agreement were signed. And both of these were patently false. The association agreement, as you mentioned, was about trade. It wasn't about defense. It wasn't about migration. And then there were some really kind of clever campaigns launched offline as well. Russia sent fake Ukrainians to town halls throughout the Netherlands, claiming to be Ukrainian. Some of them were Russian. Some of them had lived in the Netherlands and had some Ukrainian heritage. And they were claiming that Ukraine was a corrupt society, that, Ukrainians didn't actually even want to be part of the European Union, that this was the corrupt government's choice and not Ukrainians' choice. And based on kind of the way that Dutch politics works, you know, you see somebody in front of you claiming to be Ukrainian, you're not going to check their passport. And they're saying all these things about the referendum. Well, you're not going to go vote for that. You're not going to approve that if you're a Dutch citizen. And then there were some other very strange things that happened just a few days before the referendum. A video went viral online claiming to be of a Ukrainian paramilitary group with far right ties that was threatening the Dutch if they didn't vote in favor of the referendum with terrorist acts. Very scary video. It was quickly debunked, but not before it was picked up by the referendum's proponents. And then finally, just recently, we're seeing claims and more evidence mounting that Russia actually gave economic support to the political parties involved in the referendum in the Netherlands.
Wow. So quite a comprehensive campaign then. But just for a moment, though, Nina, let me play the role of skeptic here, okay? Because you're talking about a campaign to convince voters in the Netherlands using various tactics. I just wanted to note again that Dmytro Kuleba, who we talked to at that time, his job was to mount a public relations campaign to convince the Dutch the other way, right? On behalf of Ukraine. Now, we're not accusing him of a disinformation campaign, but in trying to understand sort of why we should be concerned about these things, I have heard pushback over the past many years that, like, everybody does this. It's just one version of PR that maybe you don't like if you're on the other side of it. Just respond to that.
Well, I think there's a few things that are wrong with that comparison. And I get this a lot as well. You know, people saying the United States does this too. The United States, or in this case, Dmytro Kuleba, is not pretending to be either, a Dutch citizen or a Russian citizen and misleading voters in the Netherlands. They actually were kind of hampered in the communications that they could legally engage in to Dutch voters because, A, they were a foreign government and had no stake in the referendum, even though it was about them. And B, they, you know, were relying on the truth. So relying on trade statistics, relying on this very boring EU document to say, no, this isn't about, you know, defense. This isn't about what you're saying it's about. It's actually just to help us toward our goal of integrating with the EU. All of this stuff, it's not as flashy and engaging as the very emotional narratives that Russia was peddling, and doing that from, you know, a totally shrouded, covert position, right? That's not what we want in a democratic society. We don't want Russia, China, Iran, or anybody else masquerading around, pretending to be someone that they're not, and amplifying lies with the help of social media, targeting those narratives to exactly the people that are going to find them most appealing. That's the difference.
Well, can I just jump in here? Because we asked Kuleba exactly about this, and he talked about the challenges of the asymmetry between lies and truth. And specifically, he pointed to some mistakes made in the Dutch media at the time.
It was providing the, for example, the position of Ukraine on that situation. And then it was providing the Russian position on that situation. And the Russian the Russian take was purely manipulative. It was basically disinformation. This Russian manipulation would still make it to the viewers or to the listeners, because, of course, you have to listen to the other side. But what do we do when the other side lies? Should we broadcast that opinion to the millions of viewers simply because it's the opinion of a liar? These are kind of challenges and things which have to be addressed by democracies if we really want to make them stronger.
This is such a central question that we're living with right now, Nina. I mean, how would you answer what Kuleba says there? What do you do when the other side just lies?
Well, I think we're seeing the implications of that right now during this election. You know, Facebook is refusing to fact check political ads with lies in them, taking money essentially to amplify and distribute those lies again, exactly to the people who are going to be most vulnerable to them. And I think it's a really, really central question. In this case, you know, Minister Kuleba was not able to, of course, influence the laws surrounding the Dutch referendum. But here in the United States, we have a chance to set a democratic standard for what, you know, the regulation of the online space should look like if you should be able to lie at scale, which is what we're talking about here. And that regulation could have ripple effects around the world because we are the headquarters for all of these platforms that have such an outsized impact on other people's lives, other cultures' lives, other nations' political futures, right? So I think we've abdicated our responsibility so far to set that standard while still protecting freedom of speech. The longer we wait about that, the more regular a fixture of American politics and global politics disinformation is going to become.
So we wanted to hear from Kuleba what his response was to the ultimate fate of this referendum in the Netherlands, which turned out to be unsuccessful. Dutch voters voted it down. And he told us that when he discovered that was the fate of the referendum, here's what he did.
Well, you know, I emptied a bottle of wine, if that could be an answer. From the very beginning, I realized that it was rather mission impossible because of all the limitations imposed on us. On the other hand, neither our public opinion nor myself could forgive doing nothing in that particular circumstances. It's like a battle against tanks and you only have a rifle in your hands, but you understand that most probably you will still get killed, but you cannot sit in the trench. You have to stand up and attack or and defend yourself from the attackers.
But Nina, again and again, people are going to ask, well, how do we know for sure that this disinformation campaign had any effect on the actual act of the people of the Netherlands casting their votes, right? That seems to be the bright line that folks draw when they decide whether or not to be concerned by disinformation campaigns. Do we have any evidence that it actually had a measurable impact in the Netherlands?
Well, I think if you look back on the media coverage that was, again, informed mostly by disinformation, if you look back on the, even if you do search results about this referendum, most of the videos that come up, even to this day on YouTube, are Russian disinformation videos. They are the ones with the most traction. They were the ones that informed the debate. They were the ones that inspired and informed the talking points of the folks that were running the referendum. So you could say that without Russian disinformation, those talking points wouldn't have been inspired. This referendum would not have happened, period. It just wouldn't have happened. And Minister Kuleba is exactly right. You know, it's impossible to counter disinformation, this highly emotional, vitriolic narrative with just the facts and a good story, which is unfortunately what Ukraine had on its side. And it's something we hear a lot in the counter disinformation space. You know, we hear folks who are advocates for NATO or advocates for other political institutions, the United Nations, or even, you know, just basic tenets of democracy saying we just need to remind people why this is so important, why they shouldn't take it for granted. And unfortunately, you can't compete narratively, even if it's, you know, a true and inspiring story. Those positive stories just don't perform as well in this online environment that we're in. Yeah. And that's what people remember down the road. So we've really got to think beyond the narrative equation here and start thinking about the mechanics of how disinformation is spread and clamping down on those vectors through which we are influencing public discourse.
You know, Minister Kuleba, when we talked to him, he definitely sounded more than a little fatigued by our current digital reality. I mean, in my mind, he sort of had this modern version of the European like fin de siècle on because he was just like, I'm so tired of having to deal with all of this. And especially because of fundamental differences between autocracies and democracies. I mean, he told us that he thinks democracies are particularly vulnerable to these types of attacks.
It doesn't matter how strong you are. this war will continue until the attacker drops, you know, this strategy. Because this is the nature of democracy. You know, this is why autocracy is more resilient in that context, because they can control the narrative, the flows of narratives inside of their countries.
And we asked him one more thing about what would he do? And Dmytro Kuleba told us that he's basically given up on the current generations, and he's really focused on young people right now in terms of how to really fight against misinformation. And here's why.
It's really hard to find the rule to shut down someone who is simply rottening. Is there such a verb to rotten? Yeah. Rottening your brains with endless manipulative interpretations of reality. So people simply get lost and they do not trust anyone. We live in times when there is no big truth anymore, and everyone chooses the truth he or she wants to believe in. The only way forward is to teach people to choose the right truth. We have to think about the future generations and teaching them to live in a world of multiple truth and making the right choices in that world. This is all what we can.
That's Dmytro Kuleba. He's now the Ukrainian Minister for Foreign Affairs. And in 2016, he was the Ukrainian minister in charge of trying to get the Dutch to support a referendum regarding a trade agreement with Ukraine. Nina, we've got about 30 seconds before we have to take a break. Do you have the same kind of weariness or even cynicism that Kuleba has?
Well, he's on the front lines of the information war, and I've been right there with him. But I do have some optimism. I think we can reach people. We just need to start investing in that. We have wasted the past 4 years in not building these programs, and it's time for the U.S. government to wake up and start equipping not only students, but, you know, voting age populations with the tools they need to navigate today's information environment.
Well, we'll talk about what those tools ought to be when we come back. This is On Point.
Three decades ago, Sterling Cunha was an angry, violent teenager facing life without parole. Today, he's a celebrated author and a peacemaker. His journey is a window into how violence is perpetuated in this country. But it's also a story about how people change.
There's no better example of a person who's prepared to be released.
And about people changing the system.
We have to reimagine what we're doing, because what we're doing isn't working.
This is Cell Blocks to Mountaintops, a podcast and video series. Subscribe now wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Tomorrow on the show, the Money Ladies will be back. Our absolute favorite finance experts, Rana Faruhar and Michelle Singletary, are going to come back on the show again to talk about the current state of the economy writ large and in your own lives. And we want to hear from you about the impact that the pandemic and the recession have had on you. What kind of things did you rely on? The first stimulus package, what did it help you achieve? How did you get by with the money from the first stimulus package? And are you relying on a second round of government assistance to do things like pay rent or the mortgage or other bills? What's going to happen to you if another stimulus package is not passed and signed? Tell us your story at 617-353-0683. That's 617-353-0683. Rana Faruhar and Michelle Singletary, the Money Ladies, will answer your questions on tomorrow's show. Today, we are talking about the anatomy of a disinformation campaign and trying to understand what tools Americans need as voters, as participants in a healthy democracy, to fight back against disinformation. And we're joined today by Nina Jankowicz. She is the Disinformation Fellow at the Wilson Center, a nonpartisan think tank, and author of How to Lose the Information War: Russia, Fake News, and the Future of Conflict. And Nina, if you can just hang on here for a second, I want to definitely bring the conversation back into the domestic context. And joining us now from Columbus, Ohio, is Frank LaRose. He is the Ohio Secretary of State. Secretary LaRose, welcome.
Hello, Meghna.
So have you seen evidence of disinformation campaigns directed at Ohio voters in this election cycle?
Sure, we have. Now, attribution is a little bit harder to figure out at this point, but we have seen information, disinformation campaigns. And good news is we've worked with Ohioans over the last 2 years to help inoculate against that kind of thing. And so I think that we're well prepared as an electorate to fight back.
Okay. And so two things. First is, what kind of things have you seen? And then what have you done to inoculate those Ohio voters?
Sure. So the kind of examples that that we know of, things like, for example, an auto dial or so-called robocall that was launched that appeared in northern Ohio that was aimed at minority community members and encouraging them to not participate in absentee voting, for example. And then just sort of the normal run-of-the-mill social media stuff that comes up from time to time. The kind of work that we've done is really, I started doing disinformation briefings, particularly targeted at minority community leaders, because really, in my mind, the most pernicious forms of election disinformation are those that are designed to get people to self-disenfranchise, encouraging people to not participate. And we wanted to make sure to fight back against that, to equip leading voices in Ohio's minority community, because unfortunately, as evidence shows back to 2016, they're often the most targeted.
So can you tell me a little bit more about that? What did the outreach look like, and how were the messages received? What specifically did you do?
Yeah, so this started off as in-person briefings that we did around the state. Obviously, it has turned into more of a virtual session,
right,
as I've been doing them. But we would gather leaders, whether it was ministers, religious leaders, folks from new American communities, immigrant communities, leaders from groups like NCP and the Urban League and the A. Philip Randolph Institute, for example, and go through a PowerPoint presentation to simply sort of demystify what is disinformation and sort of break it down. I mean, you know, we used to call this propaganda just a few generations ago, right? And it's the same kind of idea. The problem is we all carry around these propaganda delivery devices in our pockets, mm-hmm, at this point, and that makes it even more targetable. And that's why we wanted to start with educating folks, but also building relationships. We have a reporting mechanism. We use an email address. It's simply report@ohiosos.gov, so that members of the minority community in particular, but other Ohioans, can report to us if they see something that looks like disinformation, so that we can begin taking action. In the example that I mentioned in Cleveland, which was an auto dial, very unsophisticated technique, it turns out that it was domestic actors, not foreign actors. But nonetheless, we were able to engage with federal law enforcement right away and work to bring the situation to a head.
Yeah. So I'm glad that you underscored that, Secretary LaRose, because there's a lot of evidence that while maybe we in the media are focused on foreign actors, that the worst disinformation right now is probably coming from inside the United States. And I'm going to have Nina talk about that in just a second. But Nina, I did want to ask for your specific response to that in-person, well, quote-unquote in-person, but the direct contact that the secretary was making to community leaders to prepare them on how to be alerted to and fight back against disinformation. How important is that sort of community-to-community outreach in arming voters?
Yeah, Magna, this is exactly the sort of operation that I hope all secretaries of state, and I think many of them are, running. Local officials are often seen as more highly trusted than their federal counterparts. So someone like Secretary LaRose going around as a human being and talking to voters, talking to the folks who have such a high stake in this election, it's so important. It's way more effective than, you know, any press release could be, or even a clever communications campaign online. That face-to-face contact can't be understated in terms of its effectiveness.
Mm. And Secretary LaRose, you had also mentioned that you did things like that email address that you set up to have people be able to email when they had reports of misinformation. I understand that in all 88 Ohio counties, you've had election officials there sign up for verified Twitter accounts and .gov websites to prevent spoofing. Has that been effective so far?
It has been effective. And even, you know, at our smallest, most rural county boards of elections now, they all have verified social media accounts. And as you mentioned, .gov domains for their emails and their websites. And so we remind people to go to the trusted source, which is your local and your state elections officials, if you want the straight information. But of course, it also means partnering with members of the media. We did an Elections 101 training session as well around the state, to help members of the media have a deeper understanding of the nuts and bolts of elections administration, and also for them to understand disinformation, because oftentimes if you're a foreign disinformation operative and you really want to sort of win the Employee of the Year award, you want to try to get one of your disinformation stories to cross over into credentialed media. So we wanted to help inoculate and prepare Ohio's media members to be prepared for that as well.
Yeah. You know, earlier in the show, Nina had had told us that we were talking about the Florida incident with the emails there, and that it didn't require a hack for foreign actors or any malicious actors to get those emails. But I wonder, Secretary LaRose, are there other aspects of voter information or the databases or the networks even that are being used to run the election in Ohio that you're concerned about from a security point of view?
Absolutely. It's important to sort of bifurcate the conversation here, though, because any equipment that's used to receive a vote or to tabulate a vote, those machines are segregated off, air-gapped, as we call it, separated from the internet. We have also launched a security initiative in Ohio that's been nationally recognized, where we've got a monitor on every county board of elections server so that it can recognize when there's malicious traffic or whatever else, because there are aspects of the election that by nature are online. The voter registration database, the way that the board of elections uses their email and their website, those need to be protected. So we've taken some really cutting-edge steps to do that as well. But I think you're right to mention that our foreign adversaries know, and for that matter, domestic actors know, they can't actually tamper with the administration of elections in any way at scale. And so instead of trying to hack voting machines per se, they've tried to hack the voters, right, by engaging in these propaganda campaigns.
Right. I love how you put the propaganda delivery device that we're all carrying around in our pockets right now. So let me ask you, if we could just do like blue sky ideas right now, and if there's anything that you could do that right now maybe is out of reach for whatever reason in order to really further strengthen Ohio voters against the effects of disinformation, what would it be?
I think it's education. I think it's teaching people to be skeptical of what they read online. I think we all know that just because it's on a screen doesn't mean it's legitimate. You need to go to a trusted source of information, a credentialed journalist, an official state website or county website to get your information about elections. And the other thing is teaching people to think before they share. When we share something online, we're validating it. That's what drives social media. It's me telling my friends, I care about this and you should care about it too. Every time you share something, many things that we share as a public are not worth sharing. They're not reliable information. And so teaching people to do that. And then, you know, there's some longer term things, Meghna, I'd like to see. You know, we have a Geneva Convention because we've decided that in warfare, certain things are unconscionable, right? The use of chemical weapons, the use of landmines. These are things that we've determined, even in something as sort of robust as a war, these things are just beyond the pale. I think that there's a place for an international conversation about this kind of election disinformation operation being unconscionable and not something that we tolerate as a global community either.
Well, Frank LaRose is the Secretary of State for Ohio, joined us today from Columbus. Secretary LaRose, thank you so very much.
Thank you, Meghna.
By the way, I forgot to mention that the secretary is a Republican from the state of Ohio. Nina, respond to what he just said about looking sort of globally, a Geneva Convention against election-related disinformation campaigns. What do you think?
Well, I think to see that happen, we would need a very different administration in the White House right now, because the U.S. is going to have to lead on this stuff. We've seen our allies pick up some of the slack in Europe and elsewhere trying to, you know, counter disinformation on an international scale. But without our buy-in, that cannot happen. And we've seen, you know, President Trump and some of his close officials, his cabinet, really question the effects of disinformation campaigns. We've seen the president call, you know, the Russian disinformation campaign a hoax. Secretary LaRose is really speaking my language there, talking about education, talking about the threat that disinformation poses to our democratic process. And again, he's a Republican. This is a nonpartisan issue. Everyone should be concerned mm-hmm. about that. But in order to get to that sort of international, you know, consensus building, we need the top of government to care about it as well. And that's where there's been an incongruence in our policy, in our foreign policy, our national security policy about disinformation and election interference. And then on top of that, I would just add, Obviously, you know, Secretary LaRose is very concerned with elections, but everyone should understand that elections are just an inflection point in a disinformation campaign. These campaigns are laid over time. They allow, you know, a vector for influence for a foreign adversary. But these are years long campaigns, and we all need to be on guard throughout, you know, our day to day lives, not just in an election season.
So we only have about 4 minutes left, Nina, and I want to spend the bulk of that time talking more about tools for individual voters, for citizens. Mm-hmm. But I do have to just make mention here, since you talked about the President Trump right now and his relationship with welcoming disinformation at times. I mean, how would you characterize the whole Hunter Biden story?
It's difficult to characterize. And the reason that I hesitate to even, you know, make a conjecture about whether a foreign adversary is involved is because we know so little about this story. What we know has been, you know, laundered through media outlets that are sympathetic to Rudy Giuliani and Steve Bannon's version of events. And Bannon and Giuliani have refused to let any independent investigators look at this purported laptop and the files on it. If we had some cyber experts looking at that stuff, telling us, you know, whether any of the documents are doctored there, we know, for instance, Russia has hacked documents and then put in forged documents among them. This is a tactic they've used for decades, in fact, or whether they were stolen by a domestic adversary. All of this is important context for voters. And right now, we don't have any of that context. And I think that is why we are seeing so few media outlets even trying to pursue the story, because until we are able to independently verify the claims and not just take Mr. Giuliani and Mr. Bannon at their word, then it's not really a story that is worth its journalistic salt, frankly. Yeah,
you heard the reluctance in my voice to even bring it up, but in the whole sort of ecosystem of disinformation, it's lying out there as an issue. So let's get back in the last 3 minutes that we have to brass tacks here. So, you know, what would you recommend first? Just briefly, be done at the federal level here in the United States, not for this election cycle, but to your point, if disinformation is always with us, to really push back against it.
Well, we do need to establish some firm red lines that we will not tolerate based on what foreign adversaries are doing. Again, those have been muddled by the Trump administration. We have imposed some sanctions on Russia for its foreign interference activity, but they are accompanied with a scoop of, you know, credulousness from the president. And I think that's a problem. So firm red lines. Secondly, you know, we need to think beyond just playing whack-a-troll. Whether that's with the social media platforms or, you know, with Russian trolls at the federal government level, we need to think about inoculating our publics, as Secretary LaRose was talking about. And this is a big theme that comes out in my book. Not only do we need to talk about the sort of education that Minister Kuleba mentioned earlier, we need to talk about equipping the public media with the funding and the resources that they need to deliver trustworthy information to the public. I mean, I don't need to tell you, Meghna, that NPR and PBS are some of the only mechanisms for local news delivery in a lot of news deserts around the country. And we spend, through the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, $1.35 per person per year on public media in this country. And if we are investing in journalism as a public good, as journalism as something that informs voters and allows them to make choices in our democracy, whatever choice they want to make, but do it with good information, right? I think we will go a long way toward pushing back against these vacuums that disinformation essentially, you know, exploits. The local news vacuums, the vacuums of information that are, you know, allowing people to, or encouraging people to search for alternative sources. That's the sort of thing that public media can combat. And then there are a whole host of, you know, legislative solutions that I think Congress is starting to consider. We'll see a hearing this week with some of the tech executives about Section 230, which allows the platforms becomes a lack of intermediary liability for things that their users post. That is to protect freedom of speech. But again, this is going to be a huge issue no matter who wins the presidential election. And it starts with individuals.
Well, I keep thinking about what Minister Kuleba said about this is a world that's designed to rot your brain, to challenge your perception of reality. So if things are coming at you that are designed to make you fearful or that look suspicious, they probably are. That's what I'm going to leave people with for today. Nina Jankiewicz, author of How to Lose the Information War, Russia, Fake News, and the Future of Conflict. Thank you so much, Nina, for joining us again today.
It was a pleasure, Meghna. Thank you.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices, and they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons, and there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.